I'd like to thank John and the organizers for inviting me to this plenary session. And as I reflected on what John said, I realize now why I'm so tired and turning gray so rapidly. So John described that I'm a physician here at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, and I work in the Faculty of Medicine at University of British Columbia. And in 1997, John Hoey, who had a year prior become the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, we met, and he offered me an opportunity to be an associate editor on a trial basis for about a year, and that relationship just ended in terms of the Canadian Medical Association Journal in March of 2006 after he was fired. So we had an opportunity, a team that he created, to work together for a long time. So I'd like to talk to you about the good, the bad, and the ugly of medical publishing. And the good is obviously, I don't think anyone here in this room needs to be convinced, is the open access model. It's a healthier publishing model. And I hope open medicine will be an example of how we can do this. The bad, in my opinion, is the current biomedical publishing model. It impedes scientific progress in global public health. And the ugly is the resultant lack of knowledge dissemination. And that's the impetus for why we're doing what we're doing at Open Medicine. So the ugly, this is a conflict between publisher and editors, and it's a recurring theme. And so what it says is, right, the daily slag. Doctor saves lives on page 26, but lead with GP Steele's pencils on pages 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, and I want pictures. So in 1992, there was a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and I'm going to give you a bunch of slides here that describe examples of conflict between editors and publishers. And this is the first one that I'm aware of that was so high profile. This study criticized the accuracy of advertisements in the journal, and several large pharmaceutical companies subsequently withdrew advertising in the journal to the tune of about $1 to $1.5 million of lost revenue. And so then there was tension between the publisher of the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is the American College of Physicians, and the two editors, Susan and Robert Fletcher. And they subsequently resigned in 1993 because of these tensions. And in a subsequent interview, Robert Fletcher is quoted as saying, "The pharmaceutical industry certainly showed us that advertising dollars could be a two-edged sword, a carrot or a stick. And if you ever wondered whether they'll play hardball, that was a pretty good demonstration that they do." In 1999, I think this is a case that probably many of you may have heard of. George Lundberg was then the editor-in-chief of the Journal of American Medical Association, and he was fired by the American Medical Association for fast-tracking a publication of a report about college students to determine when or what behaviors these respondents thought determined or constituted having sex. So the article was published at the same time as President Clinton's statement that he did not have sex with that woman, meaning Monica Lewinsky. And the AMA justified firing George Lundberg on the grounds that he swayed from politics away from science and medicine. And really that raises the issue or the question of who's responsible for content and who owns the journal and what does editorial freedom really mean. And all medical associations also have a political arm to them. I mean, medicine is a political, has political influence. And for example, for the AMA, they do lobby the U.S. government. They lobby the Democrats and the Republicans. And at that time, their donations to the political parties was 2-1 in favor of the Republicans. And so this was potentially seen as being sympathetic to the Democratic president. Another example is in 1999 when editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, Jerry Kassir, resigned over differences in the opinion between the parent publisher, which was the Massachusetts Medical Society, over the use of the New England Journal of Medicine brand. The fact remained that the society wanted to use the New England Journal of Medicine's reputation and brand to market products such as Journal Watch that weren't actually vetted by the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine. So he had a great deal of concern about this, and he asked publicly, is this a business, or are we trying to produce quality content? And the Massachusetts Medical Society is a not-for-profit organization. However, I'll show you work later that suggests that it's probably making a very handsome profit, and it'd be really interesting to see how it's distributed. So This brings us to our experience in 2006. So the history of the Canadian Medical Association's breach of editorial independence is very well recorded in a report produced by Jerry Kassirer on editorial dependence, and it was published in the CMAJ. And there's also a piece that was done by Miriam Shookman, published in the New England Journal last year. And essentially, the firing seemed to be a culmination of recurring tensions between the CMA and the senior editors that escalated, especially after the CMAJ was transferred from the CMA to the CMA Holdings Company in January of 2005. So the editors at the CMAJ reported a transgression of editorial independence early online in December of 2005. And it was over an investigative news article on behind-the-counter access to emergency contraception, otherwise known as Plan B. And the editorial essentially described how our independence was compromised in November when the publisher instructed us to withhold the article in response to a complaint by the Canadian Pharmacists Association. And the Canadian Pharmacists Association had learned about the story when the CMAJ's investigative news reporters actually went to them and asked them questions about what they thought by the fact that pharmacists in communities were actually asking women about their personal sexual histories prior to dispensing this medication, and it's actually violating the guidelines that the pharmacists were supposed to operate against. So the Canadian Pharmacists Association obviously saw this as bad press and probably golfed with all the people in the CMA and made a quick call over to the CMA president, who then spoke to the CMA publisher. And the next thing you know is that they're objecting to us publishing this, and they're stating that what was the propriety of our investigation? Is this actually research? Because you had women go volunteer and go in and ask for this drug, and they questioned the boundary between news reporting and scientific research. And in the end, we ended up publishing a negotiated version of the article, and we did that because we felt we had an obligation to tell the important story with public health implications, then to withhold it on the grounds of interference. So in short, the CMA prioritized its relationship with another professional body over patient care. They demonstrated the disconnect in the values of the CMA and the editorial team. And then they made this disconnect operational by actually interfering with the editorial autonomy of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. So we probably should have just meekly gone to our corners, but seemed to escalate everything. And what happened is we then published a news story in February 7, 2006, reporting on the appointment of the Federal Minister of Health, Tony Clement. And in the article, Mr. Clement was dubbed by his common media name, Two-Tier Tony, based on his favorable stance towards privatization of healthcare when he was the Ontario Minister of Health. So the story was removed by direct order of the publisher, and a revised and more supportive version was subsequently published 2 days after the firings of John Hoey and Anne-Marie Todd-Kill on February 22nd. Once again, there was a prioritization of optics regarding the new federal minister of health and the relationship of the CMA, the Canadian Medical Association, with this ministry. And the name Two-Tier Tony was nothing new in the media, and it appears only the Canadian Medical Association was upset. So the infraction of editorial independence was brought to the attention of the Journal Oversight Committee, which John Hoey had convened a few years earlier when there was editorial interference that had occurred then. And essentially, there was no substantial response. And in the report that Jerry Kassirer and a group of people investigated about this, he noted that the editorial independence at the CMAJ was essentially illusory, and the Journal Oversight Committee was essentially ineffectual. So the CMA fired the editor and chief, John Hoey, and the senior deputy editor, Anne-Marie Todd-Kill, soon after the Tony Clement story. And essentially, the CMA never provided credible reasons for the firing or their inability to adopt the 10-point governance plan put forth by Steve Choi, who had been formerly the deputy editor and now had assumed the position of the acting editor. And this 10-point governance plan was something that came out of the firing of George Lundberg at the Journal of the American Medical Association. And they worked hard to negotiate this relationship between the journal and the AMA. And we thought we had a similar situation between the Canadian Medical Association Journal and the CMA, but for some reason they couldn't adopt those principles, which had been vetted and thought through a few years prior. And, you know, the reasons for the firing that were initially given by the publisher and the CMA president at that time included it was time for a fresh approach, and I'll read this plug-in, air freshener is useless, it still stinks in here. And then eventually there were irreconcilable differences between publisher and John Hoey and Anne-Marie Todkill. So despite a lot of media coverage and online posting, both before and after the Pound Panel, which the CMA convened to reinvent another governance plan. And they tried to propose a suitable governance model for the CMAJ, which the CMA has adopted. But they always said, you know, we believe in editorial independence, but they actually have never acknowledged that they did interfere with the editorial autonomy of the CMAJ. And I think until you're able to say, we did this, and now we're going to move forward, it's all rings rather hollow to us. So the bottom line is that publisher and editor relations often turn on differences in priorities and values. And when the publisher's goal is to serve advertisers and paying subscribers, and the financial or political interests of its members, editorial autonomy always has the potential of being compromised. So clearly what I wanted to show you, what has happened to us has happened elsewhere. And where there are competing interests, there's always a very real risk that the publisher will interfere. So our lessons learned is that effective governance depends on the integrity of both parties, the publisher and the editor. And an editor who doesn't share the values of the association or the publisher is certainly vulnerable to the loss of autonomy. And a truly independent journal, maybe it's strong to say cannot exist, but has great challenges in existing within a traditional publisher and editor relationship, particularly in biomedical publishing, where there are so many competing interests that I will also show you. So this gave us time to take stock and think about what is important to us. So we had the opportunity to do this, and we found ourselves realizing that we wanted to create a journal that reflected these values. Open access, which obviously includes the fact that the author retains copyright and we're using the Creative Commons license, publishing excellence, editorial autonomy, financial independence from groups or corporations that could influence practice, political independence, local community and international engagement, and finally, technological innovation. So the current model of publishing, and I've taken this from PLOS, the Public Library of Science. So you write the paper, you give your work to the publishers after editing it, revising it, going back with letters. You hand over your copyright to them. They then sell their work to wealthy readers and libraries, mostly in high-income countries. And then the work is then subject to extremely tight copyright restrictions. So the current model of medical publishing really restricts access, and it revolves around the private ownership of research results and available in a timely way only to those who can pay. And may I add that a lot of the research results are from taxpayer dollars. The results of billions of dollars of research funding, for example, in the U.S., the NIH spent $28 billion in 2004, can be seen by only a small fraction of the intended audience because it is published in journals that few individuals or institutions can afford to subscribe to. For example, in the neurosciences, the annual subscription to brain research costs $20,000 a year. So these are examples of online access. So this title is Cesarean Section and Risk of Unexplained Stillbirth and Subsequent Pregnancy. So if you wanted to read that, it's in The Lancet, Elsevier's the publisher, and you're not part of a library consortium that has access to this journal, you have to pay $30. I'd like you to note the title of this paper. It's called Impediments to Promoting Access to Global Knowledge in Sub-Saharan Africa. And it costs $25 to get, U.S. So there is a journal crisis, and the journal prices have risen 4 times faster than inflation since the mid-80s. It's become a heavy burden for libraries, and these prices have limited access to scholarly information, particularly for low-income countries. And restricted access really does drive big profits. You know, a high-profile drug can earn a journal and publisher $1 million in reprint sales. The market leader, Elsevier, earns profits of $290 million a year with margins of 40% on its core journal business. And the medical publishing industry is the fastest growing subsector of the media in the past 15 years. So restricted access also can do harm. It impedes global research. It contributes to knowledge gap in developing or low-income countries. It hampers capacity building and collaboration. And finally, clinicians, patients, and health policymakers really can't make decisions based on all the available information. And it really is harder for researchers and practitioners in low-income or developing countries to collaborate on global health issues. So I'm going to switch to advertising. And what it says here is, our goal is to fool most of the people most of the time. So their goal is to fool most of the doctors most of the time. So should we help them do this when we talk about pharmaceutical industry advertising? So I'd like to acknowledge a lot of the content that's coming in the next set of slides is from the Public Library of Science Medicine article by Adrian Fugue-Bergman. It's called Advertising in Medical Journals, Should Current Practices Change? It's an very interesting article, and I encourage people who are interested to follow up and read this. It was actually a big eye-opener for me because I didn't realize how bad the situation was. So pharmaceutical ads are driving a $9 billion a year drug industry and accounts for $448 million of medical journal revenue in 2003. And medical journals are essentially dependent on revenue from pharmaceutical and medical device advertising. So there's something fundamentally wrong to have this level of corporate interest be part of your matrix of publishing. So the main purpose of drug ads is to sell more drugs, not really to educate physicians. And actually, the Supreme Court in the United States agreed with this position that the ACP, the American College of Physicians, who publish the Annals of Internal Medicine, could not get an educational tax benefit for pharmaceutical advertising income because the ads were for products that were not necessarily superior. So the ads in the journals. So in 96, five of the six physician organizations raised over 10% or more of their total annual revenue from pharmaceutical advertising. And in 2004, advertising in the American Medical Association publications constituted about 15% of their total AMA revenues. So they generated about $41 million from advertising, and that's more than twice the $17.5 million they get from actual paying subscriptions. So as an association journal, so in 1995, 12% of journal editors reported conflicts between editors' editorial decisions and the advertisers' wishes, and 20% reported that they had no control over advertisements. So the journals also court the pharmaceutical advertiser. So they court them in a publication that goes to all the pharmaceutical companies called Medical Marketing and Media. And this is cited from October 2000 and November 2003, some of their issues. So I'm not picking on the New England Journal of Medicine. That in medicine, that's the highest impact journal we have. But I'm just using it because it has most brand recognition, so most of you have probably heard of it. And the other thing is, I think all of the biomedical journals that have traditional publishers do the same thing, so that's just a caveat. But things like, you'll be amazed at what a week in the New England Journal can do. Once a week, your advertising message is delivered to physicians who make decisions and influence the decisions of others. The place to be for important news, important readers, and important prescribers. Place your ad in the New England Journal of Medicine and make our relationship with the medical community yours. And this is the Endocrine Society for their journal. The highly cited articles published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism discuss the application of your company's therapeutic products in the treatment of various endocrine disorders. They also do reader surveys. So the New England Journal advertising card says, to help you determine physicians' reading and prescribing habits, the New England Journal of Medicine conducts an independent market research and subscribes to, I don't know what this stands for, this focus. To learn how this research can benefit your product's marketing efforts, please contact your regional sales director or visit our website. And when you go to that website, it provides a free copy of a number of marketing studies to help with advertising. And these studies include essential journal study, the highly influential physician study, formulary study, reprint study. It just goes on and on. There's heavy marketing research done. So for a not-for-profit company, it seems like they're doing a lot of big business. So it makes you think about who do our journals serve? And really, there's no requirement to demonstrate greater efficacy as a condition of advertising. And as a service to advertisers, side-by-side advertising of competing drugs is avoided. So this is from the Annals of Internal Medicine. Competitive products are separated by no fewer than 4 pages for primary indication only, as reflected in the ad content. So, you know, the current model of publishing seems to be driven by a profit motive, and there's really little space devoted to covering health issues of the low-income or developing world. And it's because, did I miss a slide? Yeah. Editors must prioritize what will sell ads and reprints, and editors must prioritize audiences who can afford to buy such pharmaceutical and device advertisers and subscribers. And most of these people are in wealthy nations. So, in terms of access and dissemination, one would have thought that the goal of a medical journal should be to put as much useful information into as many hands as it can to improve human health. I had it backwards, sorry about that. So the current model creates conflict. So the revenue from pharmaceutical clients versus the research-based best medical practice, political and collegial relationships versus best interests of patients and policy, and profit from publications versus best interests in progress in global health. So this is also from PLOS, a cartoon that they developed. Sir Madam, free those journals for liberty is a handmade of science. And the door that we're trying to push down is the Scientific Publishers, Inc. And maybe we are going to break it, but we have a long road to travel. So we would say that a healthier publishing model for medicine. In thinking about that, our first responsibility is to do no harm. But we thought it would have been irresponsible after we left the Canadian Medical Association not to develop a medical publishing model that would serve Canadians with greater integrity. And so as John mentioned, that's how we met him. Hoey had invited John Walensky to the Canadian Medical Association Journal Board months before his firing. And interestingly, no one had ever had the opportunity to meet him prior to the Canadian Medical Association Journal meltdown. But subsequently, we developed a very important relationship to him and his work in the months that followed. And I wouldn't be up here speaking about this. We wouldn't have the journal if we hadn't really forged that relationship with John. It's been instrumental to what we're doing. And the team at the Public Knowledge Project, they're amazing people. So John, as you all know, is the author of The Access Principle, which answers the question, how would you ensure the university's contribution to a fair world if access to the research it produces about itself is itself a source of inequality? So we thought about the open access publishing, and really subscription fees did make sense before the internet, when you had to do printing and binding and mailing, and each additional paper copy costs an additional amount. But with online publishers, we have a one-time fixed cost, so the cost for 2 people to read the material is equivalent to the cost of 2,000 readers. So why do we charge all 2,000 readers? A lot of people have had issues with online journals, saying they're not going to have an impact, they're not, you know, the quality, there's always this, there's a lot of naysayers, but I just like to illustrate the example of the Public Library of Science Initiative, PLOS Medicine, which is a peer-reviewed open access journal. So when we define impact factor, which I think all of you are familiar with, you know, the citations in a given year to all articles, over the number of articles deemed to be citable. So PLOS's first impact factor was 8.4, and the 2006 impact factor has actually risen to 13.5. And by way of reference, the impact factor of the BMJ was 9, and the impact factor of CMAJ was 7.4. So PLOS has overtaken those other journals, and it's a much more recent addition to biomedical publishing. Another very interesting innovation, and we're talking to the people at PLOS and PLOS One about their innovations, is that PLOS One was launched in 2007, and it's publishing science, and their mission is to accelerate scientific dissemination. So they don't just publish in one particular area of science, they publish in science and in medicine, so it's very multidisciplinary content. And they have all these academic editors that they distribute the content to and vet. the papers and then send out to peer review. So in less than, they launched in 2007, and in less than 6 months, they've published, managed to publish over 500 papers, and they're quite innovative on their site with articles. They have discussion threads, post-publication review. You have opportunities to annotate their results and their methods. All you have to do is sign in, and you have access to do this. So all the research articles become living documents in a sense, and it really enhances interactivity of the information on this website. So I'm going to turn to the mission of Open Medicine. So with the understanding that science and practice of medicine are global endeavors for the benefit of humanity, the mission of Open Medicine is to facilitate the dissemination of high-quality health research, to promote international dialogue and collaboration on health issues, to improve clinical practice, and to expand and deepen the understanding of health and healthcare. So our advertising policy then follows from our mission. We're not accepting advertising from any business or organization whose activities are inconsistent with our mission. So obviously, we don't accept advertising from pharmaceutical or medical device ads. And also no ads for continuing medical association that's funded by pharmaceutical or medical device companies. So we've actually taken away the usual source of income from medical journals. And our reader survey policy, you saw how the New England Journal had all these survey data that they were willing to give to pharmaceutical advertisers. So we're not going to sell any information about our readers' reading or prescribing habits to pharmaceutical or medical device companies. So we're not about the money, it's clear, because we're all volunteering, and we're about the science and the practice of medicine. So this is a page that is published through the PKP and using the Open Journal system. And here we have highlights, and now this is called What's New in Open Medicine and our editorial. So we have a homepage, issues, we have a blog, resources for authors, reviewers, advertisers about Open Medicine, which has all our policies and search. And we have quick links of why publish with Open Medicine, how to submit a manuscript, and educating people on what is open access. And in our inaugural, our first issue, we had research content. We had three high-quality research papers, a review that received a lot of media attention, which I'll get into later. We had commentaries and analysis pieces, a clinical practice piece, and Jerry Kassir actually did a book review for us on pharmaceutical ethics. So I just wanted to highlight the systematic review by Gordon Guyatt that was published in our inaugural issue. And it received a lot of attention in the Canadian and U.S. media, in the blogosphere, and it was an in-focus piece in Scientific American. So we feel rather fortunate that we got so much media attention with our first issue. So this is what I'm telling all my colleagues and everyone I can who produces science in medical area. So we want you to publish with Open Medicine if your purpose is to advance science and improve health, because we think science and medicine will advance more quickly when knowledge is freely available and widely disseminated, and it's probably true for all disciplines. Publish with Open Medicine if you believe publishing in a closed venue is inconsistent with the spirit of science or the goals of medicine. And this is a quote from Anthony Costello and David Osterin in London. Faced with the option of submitting to an open access or closed access journal, we now wonder whether it's ethical for us to opt for closed access. When you have these choices now. And I'd like to draw your attention to our lead editorial of our inaugural issue that best articulates why we did this. And sometimes I have to reread this editorial when I'm feeling overwhelmed or blue, because it has been a challenging process, because we all are doing this in addition to all of our other personal and professional responsibilities. But we do think it's important. So we also wanted to highlight that we can publish in this medical journal. It will enhance your work because we're peer-reviewed. We have an experienced editorial team with a proven track record. We have a prominent editorial board. We're broad scope. We're internationalists. And our quality is high. We have a current acceptance rate of 17%. And this is our editorial board. And what I wanted to highlight here is that it is comprised of many people from the former Canadian Medical Association editorial board, but we've also expanded it to include many others, in particular people outside of North America, including people from Sweden, the UK, Mexico, Argentina, India, and Uganda. The other thing that I think we offer in Canada and compared to most other medical journals is that we allow authors to retain ownership of their work using the Creative Commons license, so there's no need to order reprints, and anyone can reprint, distribute the content with attribution to the author and the source. So we've chosen the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 2.5 Canada license, and that allows you to distribute freely the work. And if you make derivative works from this or remix or mashup, the only condition we ask is that you share alike, which means that you also make it open. You don't subject that work to restrictive copyright. So publish with Open Medicine if you want technological innovation to enhance your publication and maximize post-publication discourse on your research. So in the subsequent slides, I'm going to go through examples of this. We have collaborative online reading tools that we're developing or further developing with the PKP. That the reading tools were already there as part of the Open Journal system. They're wonderful. We've started this rapid response. We have an Open Medicine blog by Dean Giustini, which enhances interactivity and provides context to our articles. The remix reuse content of articles through the Creative Commons license allows for translation, and additional information can be added to your work, creating added value for the readership. So, for example, yesterday we published this article called Standards for the Measurement of Birth Weight, Length, and Head Circumference at Term in Neonates of European, Chinese, and South Asian Ancestry. And essentially the gist of this article, which will have implications on practice, was that because people of different origins biologically are of different sizes when they're born, a lot of times people were being classified as small or large and then pathologized as saying there's something wrong with this baby, or the baby is big, this baby is small. But actually they've done a study where they've created new growth charts for these newborns. And so I think it's a huge contribution. We feel so fortunate to be able to have it. So along this side of the article on the HTML, we have add a comment, we have how to cite, print version, notify a colleague, email the author. We can look at the author's work, related studies. We have the opportunity to link to government health sites, other databases, other search media. So I think this is great in terms of the interactivity. In terms of the rapid response, we published a paper called What Prosperous Highly Educated Americans Living in Canada Think of the Canadian and U.S. Healthcare Systems. And then we invited, prior to the publication, a week prior, we invited two people who are knowledgeable in health policy and issues of financing healthcare and attitudes about access and waiting lists to comment. And so what we had were rapid responses that came within 2 weeks of the article, and they were 750 words long. And they give more context to the findings, and sometimes they're critical of the research, but that's fine. It's about trying to create more dialogue on the content that we post. Dean Giustini, who's a UBC medical health librarian, has been at the forefront of blogging. He has a very successful blog that people have followed. He's written for the BMJ, has been speaking to the National Library of Medicine about Web 2.0 in medicine. And he highlights a paper authored by John Walensky, a working paper about doing medical journals differently, open medicine, open access, and academic freedom. And so that's what he does. He takes content from what he's reading and brings it into the blog. He highlights things from our journal and relates it to other things. You know, he adds that added value. And this is an example of the remash and the remixing or derivative works. So this is a figure from Public Library of Science Medicine depicting the drug development pipeline. So this is a wonderful figure about discovery, pre-development, development, and then availability to patients. And so I realize the print is small, but here it's like from the new drugs for neglected diseases pipeline, and it has a citation. So what happened is that this figure was there, and then it was remixed in the Drugs and Neglected Disease Initiative newsletter, and they could do it because of the kind of copyright it has. It's by attribution. So what this newsletter did is they took this figure and then they added content to it rather than reinventing the wheel and trying to figure out another figure. And here what they did is they looked at projects that are ongoing and new projects, color-coded them, and described what drugs are now being developed for the various parasitic diseases that are quite prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa and certain Asian countries. So I think this is a wonderful example of remix or using derivatives. And this was not hampered or stifled by copyright because they could just go and do this. Whereas, you know, you'd have to go and get permission and then you might have to pay for the figure. You know, this has eliminated the barriers to do that. And as you know, most of us realize that discovery is really made by building on existing work. Most people don't have ideas in vacuums, and so I think this is the one thing that this highlights. So the other thing about open medicine, if you believe, as we do, that Canadians have a perspective on healthcare and healthcare values that need to be shared and promoted, and I encourage you to link to our associate editor's blog by Dr. James Maskelyk in Sudeley, Sudan. So James was part of the beginning of the journal, and he has managed to edit a few papers while he's been in Abyei, Sudan, and he's been blogging regularly there about his experience. And I just want you to get a sense that, you know, we're not just a bunch of people just sitting around thinking that this needs to be done, that needs to be done. You know, I think a lot of us are trying to actually do something out there to make this place better. So publish with us if you believe independence is essential to restoring and maintaining integrity of the medical publishing. So I hope I've convinced you that pharma money creates editorial bias. It undermines good practice. And really, commercial and association publishers interfere when it suits their political and commercial needs. So the other part is the technological innovation using the open journal systems and the open source software. You know, we contribute to the development of ideas and code by stating what we need, and then the PKP group develop pieces that we can then use to enhance the function of our site. We use Drupal, which is open source, to manage the open medicine blog. MJ Suhunas has worked hard on the XML conversion, which we're going to be piloting to allow us to go to the National Library of Medicine for indexing. It's a publicly available resource, and it does improve the global circulation of knowledge. And we hope we can be an example to other journals that this is what you can do in biomedical publishing, especially in low-income countries. So making it viable, as you know, open access is a publishing platform and not a business model. And as you all know, editing, producing, and hosting and promoting costs money. There are some options for funding, subsidy from host universities, in particular the faculties of medicine and health sciences and other scholarly institutions. So I have met with our dean at the Faculty of Medicine at UBC, and he was, in general, supportive, and we tried to persuade him as to why he should be supporting open medicine. And I think he is starting to see the light, and I'm hoping he'll leverage his position with the other deans across the country. We could go to moderate fees to institutions as a possibility, author processing fees, and in most open access journals, they are charged by about half of them to offset costs, and they're waived for economic hardship. I know Biomed Central charges about $1,500 on average, and PLOS is much higher, $2,500 per article. If we were to charge, we think that's too high of a cost, so I think we would use a much lower amount, but we haven't worked it out. So right now, we're not charging authors because we want to get content. Also, we're going to foundations and philanthropy, and the research library is developing a cooperative for publishing. We've had the wonderful support from the Simon Fraser University, where they're doing website hosting and tech support. We've had other in-kind contributions, legal incorporation, website design initially by University of Ottawa. Tarek Lubani has been our tech specialist. He's just recently graduated medical students, and I think he's one of the many very savvy young people who have grown up with sophistication around using computers and the internet and realizing and being able to leverage this technology. And so he's hosted our editorial wiki and has really helped with the website development. And really all of the editors have contributed their time and money to launch this project. So we want to have mission-based or non-pharma advertising. We've already received some sponsorship from the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, from the Centre for Health Evaluation Outcome Studies, and a Clarity Research Group at McMaster. I'm hoping I can add the UBC Faculty of Medicine soon. And the donations from individual readers, we've received some. And now through the Public Knowledge Project, UBC and the Faculty of Education is serving as our fiscal sponsor and can issue charitable receipts. I'll be handing my hat out at the end, so if any of you are interested. So our team, it's really a team. We put this hierarchical thing, co-editor, deputy editor, associate editor, but in a sense it's for name only because I don't think any of us could have done this alone, and we really have this interdependence with one another, and there are times when one person will take more leadership and other times where they'll sit back. And that's just probably the reality of this kind of organizations that's based on volunteerism, that we all have to chip in at different times, and sometimes we have to chip in more than others. So essentially we are a motley crew. I don't know if you can see it, but that's the group. So we've never actually all gotten together at one time, and we're hoping to have our first editorial board meeting in November of this year in Toronto, because a lot of people are in Ontario. And we've actually secured the former editor-in-chief from the British Medical Journal, Richard Smith, who recently published a book called The Trouble with Medical Journals. And so he's going to come and be our speaker. So we feel really honored that he would take his time to do that. And I'd also like to thank the people at the Public Library of Science who've been hugely supportive. Rather than being competitive, they have been incredibly supportive, giving us slides, giving us content, sharing their ideas. So it's just a different model. There's a lot more generosity with open access publishing. So I just wanted to highlight our board of directors as well. That oversee us. And so that's Timothy Evans, who's the World Health Association Organization Assistant Director General. We have Aaron Freeman, a Policy Director of Environmental Defense, trained as a lawyer. Catherine O'Hara, Professor of Journalism, Carleton University. Robert Madden, a tax lawyer. Leslie Weir, Chief Research Librarian, University of Ottawa. And Jerome Kassir, Editor Emeritus, New England Journal of Medicine, and Professor of Medicine at Tufts University. So I'm going to close with that, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.